On this week's 51%, we explore what the decline in remote work opportunities means for some women workers.
We've got 5 years of this habituation that now have to be rethought. So there's financial, emotional, mental considerations. Not to say that it doesn't affect men too, but women have less earning power.
We also learn about a new mentorship program for underserved women in New York's Ulster County. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. During the pandemic, we saw how women in the workplace were particularly squeezed by school closures and social distancing mandates. A lot of moms were left doing double duty as an employee and a homeschool teacher of sorts as their kids moved to remote instruction at home. And of course, if they didn't have a job that allowed them to work from home in the first place, they might have had to choose whether to go to work or stay home and watch the kids. But for a lot of people, the days of working from home appear to be over. More and more companies are requiring their employees to return to the office, and the number of fully remote positions on the market is dwindling. So is remote work really dead? And what does this mean for women in the workplace now? I spoke with Julie Gedreau, Dean of the College of Business at SUNY's Empire State University, to learn more. Gedreau's research specifically focuses on power imbalances in the workplace. She says remote work exposed a lot of obstacles and opportunities on that front.
Management scholarship has often operated under an assumption that the best work happens at a desk in an office. And the pandemic showed that that's not entirely true. It also exposed that there are inequalities or asymmetrical opportunities and resources, because I think about, what if someone does not have hardware at home or a space to work? Then that becomes a not taken for granted that someone can adapt to working remote. And some of the most more vulnerable populations, that asymmetry of opportunity and resources was exposed. And then on the other side, for those who are less resourced, it also eliminated the need to commute to an office. So it's not a binary, was it a good thing? Was it a bad thing? Was it a complete crisis? Maybe at the time, but then it showed how technology and flexibility and adaptation can flourish.
We're seeing a shift now, though, to push people back into offices. Why are companies implementing these return to office mandates?
I want to go back to the idea that the best work happens in an office where folks can see each other and experience each other in person. There's a assumption or a thought that culture and collaboration, not entirely untrue, culture and collaboration happen better in person. I'm not refuting that entirely. I think there is something to be said for if we were in person. There would be another element to it. But doing an interview this way is almost as good. And factoring in everything that you don't have to do to have a Zoom meeting or a Teams meeting or virtual, I think it's a net positive. So another reason is very, very pragmatic why there's a return to office push is the physical plant of workplaces, the fixed assets that are in an organization, some of the fixed utility costs that may or may not be completely controllable. At some point, particularly here in the Northeast, you do have to heat a building a little bit, maybe not as if it were fully occupied, but there's very tangible material reasons why. And it might not be that easy for an employer to divest themselves of that fixed overhead. So that's not exactly a managerial reason or a leadership reason or a humanitarian reason, but a very financial reason. Another aspect of it is a mindset that people are managed better when you can see them, when you can like track them badging in and walk by their office and see their light on, et cetera. And that is not entirely untrue, But there's a discipline involved, an investment involved in managing remote in a distributed environment, doing that well, because a manager and a leader has to take the time to invest in how often will we touch base? What are the deliverables? How will we check in? How will I keep employees accountable? That I think can be background music, that the volume of that consciousness gets so low that it's easy to forget to do it. And so then I hold managers, including myself, to account for creating that infrastructure where folks know, here's when I check in, here's how I report my deliverables, here's how often we're going to meet. Because it's easy, literally, it's so cliche, but it's true, out of sight, out of mind. And then, oh, no, come back to work because I don't know what you're doing. It's at least a two-way street.
I do think that there is a perception that people who work from home are doing other things while they're working from home. And maybe there's an element of like they're not as productive when they work from home. Have there been studies on that over the past few years to give us any concrete data in that way, one way or the other?
I don't have references at the ready to speak to that. I believe that it completely can be the case that someone is as productive working at home than working at a desk. I don't buy into it 100%. I do think that we're complex. People are complicated and work is complicated and organizations can be unpredictable. But there's something to be said for the flexibility of a hybridized work arrangement where after someone has invested in, back in 2020, the screen, the laptop, all that needs to happen to have a really good infrastructure at home, there is something to be said for the productivity that can happen when the employee's gotten in a rhythm that way. I'm not so sure that I completely personally agree with, well, it saves time. I have 2 hours back in my, I'm not so sure about that, nor can I cite research that shows that. But my impulse is not so fast, thinking that at a desk means greater productivity.
One thing we noticed during the COVID-19 pandemic was, you know, the impact that it particularly had on women in the workplace. During the pandemic, all of a sudden women were having to, you know, figure out work, but a lot of women were also having to figure out their kids not being in school and or having to do school from home. And so you kind of had that double duty going on. Working remotely may have given them a little bit more flexibility in that area, but how are we seeing these return to office mandates particularly impacting women in the workplace now?
Yeah, disproportionately. Even in 2025, although the margins are slimmer, women tend to have greater responsibility for child, just as a general reality. And so having to break habits and break patterns and structures at home where we've been able to take care of domestic related responsibilities, there's tangible cost of finding childcare, paying for it. We've got 5 years of this habituation that now have to be rethought. So there's financial, emotional, mental, material, human resource considerations. Not to say that it doesn't affect men too, but in the main, women have less earning power than men, and they're in less positions of senior leadership that are shaping these policies. So there's lots of downstream effects of return to an office for women as opposed to men. I think one other thing I'd like to add, if there's time, is there's not just an uneven effect, arguably, for women. There can be an impact on those who are differently abled or members of marginalized or underrepresented populations, because I'm just saying this for consideration, with video conferencing and technological tools and the ability to work remotely, there is an element of agency that an employee can have where they have a little bit of control over their physicality, their workspace. Whereas going into a workspace in person, we could run a risk of the bias and discrimination and the microaggressions that have happened historically. So there's just another dimension to thinking about. It's not a one size fits all proposition to say everyone come back to work.
Do you think it's possible that we could see remote work return to the scale that we saw during the COVID-19 pandemic, or is it mostly dead?
I don't anticipate and it's also probably a reflection of my temperament as an academic, I don't think it's going to be from 0 to 100 or back from 100 to 0 in either direction, because there is proof of concept that hybridized work can work, and it can work really well. It has to be designed well to work well. And I am hard pressed to imagine, anything can happen, but I'm hard pressed to imagine where Monday through Friday, 9 to 5 at an office is a norm that reestablishes itself. I just don't see that happening.
You said that this has to be designed well to work well. How do you design a hybrid workplace well to get the best results?
There has to be care and thought in the design, in the physical resources. And I mean that in a very pragmatic way. Screens, hardware, desk, chair, standing desk, whatever it is that optimizes one's ability to work in a non, you know, I'm sitting here in an office, but in a non configuration like this. So there's that element. There is also the considerations for what is the expectation for your actual hours of work. And I don't mean to sound overly managerial with that, but what I mean is, if it were, this is hypothetical, I think we know a little bit about circadian rhythms and, you know, are you a morning person, afternoon person? Might there be an opportunity to think about an employee working toward their strengths and doing the heaviest work early in the morning? I'm not suggesting this would work everywhere and in every situation, but that sort of agreement that's explicit between a supervisor and an employee. What are your work hours? What are the contours of your configuration? And if it's hybrid, communicating in advance so that the person, particularly we just talked about women and the impact of childcare, so that someone can make a plan. I'm making this up. Every Tuesday and Thursday expected to commute into the office. So structure, expectation, and I want to highlight this, mutual accountability, not just the employee, but it's on the supervisor to create that infrastructure for the employee. And that is a key piece to hybrid or remote work working at all, because I think it's a shortcut to say remote or hybrid does not work, come back to the office. If that's the reason why, that's not a good reason.
Julie Gedreau is the Dean of SUNY Empire's College of Business. You can learn more about her work at sunyempire.edu. August 26 marked the 105th anniversary of women's suffrage. The 19th Amendment was ratified on that day in 1920. Advocates of civil rights regularly celebrate it as Women's Equality Day to reflect on the progress women have made in the U.S. and all the work that still needs to be done. As Chris Bolt with the New York Public News Network reports, the status of the Equal Rights Amendment, which would offer much broader protections for people of all genders, remains uncertain.
There are those who accept the ERA as the law of the land. President Joe Biden said as much just before he left office. The American Bar Association and the Nonpartisan Center for American Progress both agree and say it's enforceable. Not so fast, says women's history expert Carrie Eaton, who says the backing needed for equal treatment in, say, a rape case or discrimination case is still lacking.
We have such variants of laws protecting women between the states, that having one overarching enshrining law saying these are the expectations of our nation in protecting women. Right now, they don't have that option.
Eaton, executive director of the famed suffragist Matilda Jocelyn Gage Center, contends lawmakers in Congress need to decide on a final path to making it the 28th Amendment. That amendment is notably not written in the National Archives or in versions at the National Constitution Center. Syracuse University history and political science professor Margaret Susan Thompson has a slightly different view based on Biden's comments.
At the time he said it, Biden was the president, and his statements, it would seem to me, have at least as much force in law as some of the executive orders, say, that President Trump has issued.
She believes the issue will be determined when a case, either challenging the ERA or one citing it, comes before the Supreme Court of the United States. Until a decision from the High Court or an act of Congress provides clarity, the would-be 28th Amendment remains in legal and constitutional limbo. Chris Bolt, WAER News.
In New York's Hudson Valley, a new nonprofit has sprung up to offer women mentorship and sisterhood. Mentoring Muse provides 6 months of one-on-one mentorship, support groups, and workshops to underserved women navigating situations like domestic violence, illness, poverty, and incarceration. Executive Director Amy Summers has years of experience running women's empowerment programs in the Hudson Valley and Western Massachusetts, most recently with United Way, which ended its women's mentorship program last year. Summers, who is currently running Mentoring Muse part-time, says the nonprofit already has financial backing from groups like Kingston's Good Work Institute. She has big goals and high hopes for how the program can help Ulster County women and potentially women across the country.
It evens the playing field in some ways. We recognize that racial injustice and social and economic inequity and trauma has acted as barriers in the lives of our mentees. We strive to help mentees level the playing field by providing support groups and resources and all these good things for them.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the program. How does it work, and what kinds of issues are you helping women with?
The structure of the program is that they are matched with a mentor. So they meet with their mentor twice a month, one-to-one. And then in between, we offer support groups and workshops. And there's a giant menu of workshops on our website. And some, you know, we address the whole person. So it's not just career-based or educational-based. It's whole person. So maybe it's about, how they identify in the world and getting to know themselves better, or self-care and that kind of thing as well. I'll give you an example. We had a woman, a domestic violence survivor. She was out of that situation. She wanted to be a first-generation college student, but in her words, she felt stupid because she never could understand why she couldn't retain information. But she presented, you know, just like anybody else, you know, intelligent and excited. But what we discover is that she had an undiagnosed learning disability her whole life. And so she got help for that. We got her into the local community college, which is fantastic out here, SUNY Ulster. And I'm on the advisory board for a program over there called New Start for Women. She got into that, and she got a one-year business certificate. And during that year, she had three deaths in her family, two of which were by gunshot.
Wow.
Just very unusual situation. And then she had to get a back operation. And she still graduated. And then she went on and became hired from the college. And then she decided that she wants to, now that she understands her learning challenges and gets the help for it, she feels empowered. She doesn't feel stupid anymore. She feels like, you know, a really empowered, smart woman, which is what she is, with a lot of life experience. And she wants to help others with learning challenges. So she wants to get into academic counseling, and she's headed toward a four-year degree. And she had a great mentor who really saw her through it all and just, you know, championed her and encouraged her and cried with her and was there for her when things that maybe somebody who has a support system might not seem a big deal, for somebody who grew up really separated from a lot of things due to childhood violence and poverty, she just to walk through the threshold of that college for the first time with her mentor, just to get to learn more about it, changed everything.
What is it about the mentor-mentee relationship that you feel brings results?
Well, again, it's very important when I do the training that I make sure that everybody understands that there's more than one possibility, there's more than one path, and even if a mentor had a challenge in her own life, that she's like, let's say the mentee may want to walk through a similar door that she did to get to her goal. And when the mentor went through that door, there was fire. And she's so her inclination would be, don't do that, don't do that, you know. But instead, she needs to understand that her mentee is her own person. She may have different socioeconomic or cultural background. She may have different coping skills and a different way to handle that fire. So there's not one formula to success. And it's not the job of the mentor to tell the mentee how to live her life. It's about really learning how to listen and how to help her figure out what's her best path. For herself. And in that, there's so much love and joy, honestly, and mutual respect. And sometimes there's like interim steps that maybe neither the mentor or the mentee realized needed to be accomplished, because the mentee will have an assignment, so to speak, like a heart work, I'd rather call it than homework. Between each meeting that she and her mentor come up with. So let's say she wants to be an entrepreneur of a certain thing. Let's say she wants to create hair care products for African American women, which is something that happened. So maybe her heart work would be to research, you know, how much that would cost, like the ingredients that she wants to use, and get like an ingredients list and a cost list for her beginning startup. But maybe when she meets back with her mentor, they discover that she couldn't get that done. Well, why? Maybe because she lives in a one room apartment and she's a single mom, and she lets her child stay up a little bit too late for her to not have that time to herself. So maybe they need to figure out, okay, well, maybe we need to figure out a set bedtime and a special space for you. How can you transition into your time? Maybe even just as simple as lighting a candle. And maybe she needs a laptop. And ideally, Mentoring Muse has a stipend for each mentee, which is what I had with Raising Hope. And I'm working on that now, trying to get a grant for that so that we can buy things like a laptop, so that somebody like this person can research the hair care products and things like that. But let's say she has that. So she just needs that sacred space just for her, and to know that that's okay to take that. You know, things are quiet in the house. It's her time now, and that's all right.
Well, I know the program's just starting, but how many mentors, mentees do you have, and where do you see it going?
So right now, because it's part-time and it's just me, I really want to have more funding so that we can do a program assistant like I had in the other program, in which case I'll double it. But right now the goal is 15 mentees and 15 mentors. That's 30 people. And the program goes for 6 months. So then it'll happen again after 6 months. And so that'll be another 30 people. And it's important to note that the mentors go through their own transformational experience as well, because they're at a point where they have all this life experience. Maybe they've just retired, or maybe they're, you know, mid-career, but just an idea to really like comb through that and give that back and realize that they have reached this point where they can share some of their experience and wisdom with another woman. And then learn from those women who have gone through so much and continue to and still have determination and grit is deeply transformational for everyone involved.
Well, Amy, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us. You mentioned that you're trying to get a stipend going for mentees. Tell me a little about some of the other projects that you're working on. How do you hope Mentoring Muse can eventually expand here?
Well, I'm working on a book. I think that would just help spread the word in their stories like these, which I think will help people, and also just tips on creating your own mentoring program. I'll tell you though, during the pandemic, I pivoted from in-person meetings to everything online. And at that point, I started getting people reaching out from Miami and San Francisco, and even Cape Verde and a little island off of West Africa. And they all said, I wanted to do something during this pandemic with women, and I found you. There's nothing like this by us. There's nothing quite like this. And so at that time, because I was doing everything virtually, this was the pandemic and the beginning of it, and we didn't know what was going on, they became mentors, and we didn't lose a beat. We still were able to create the warmth in the support groups, and they were still able to connect deeply. And so, knowing that that's possible, with the right amount of funding, Mentoring Muse could grow and be, more of a national thing, or international. But right now, we're based in Ulster County, and we're hoping to get more funding. We're very grateful for the funding that we have reached. It is hard to, get everything, get as much grant requests out there as I'd like to, but it's happening. And we have an advisory board. Our advisory board are former mentees and mentors, and they are fantastic. And in fact, one of the former mentees is on the advisory board now, and she's also just come in as a paid intern because the community college is paying her, and so she's actually interning with us. And she's grew up in the foster care system, and she really was in need of somebody to a woman to sort of nurture her and also believe in her and stand with her in her power and her dreams and dream with her and find that, path with her. And it's been fantastic. You will be a mentor soon enough, but right now she's in these roles, and it's fantastic. I just want you all to know out there that you matter, and that, if you can lift another woman up, it will also lift you up. So let's just keep lifting each other up.
Amy Summers is the executive director of Mentoring Muse, a women's mentorship nonprofit in New York. You can learn more about her work at mentoringmuse.com. Amy, thanks again.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio based in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. You can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night and down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool. Sweet bells in little girl dreams. They said, oh, I want a big life, not a house I could have been like. Where are you taking me? Where are you taking me? Said, everything I do, I feel farther removed from my own life. Where is it taking me? Where is it taking me?